This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, November 5th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. For months, pundits have been discussing the 2020 election as a transformative moment for American politics. Biden was polling well in Republican strongholds like Texas and Florida, and Donald Trump's mishandling of the pandemic had driven his approval ratings to historic lows. It seemed possible not just that Biden would win in a landslide, but that Democrats would take the Senate, strengthen their hold on the House, and prove that America was, at its heart, a moderate nation. The results on November 3rd told a different story. As of this recording, the presidential race is still undecided, but Trump performed well in traditionally red states nationwide. Control of the Senate seems likely to come down to two runoff races in Georgia. Democrats' margins in the House have shrunk, and state legislatures across the country have gone red. At a press conference yesterday, Biden struck a conciliatory tone.
I know how deep and hard the opposing views are in our country on so many things. But I also know this as well. To make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as enemies. We are not enemies. What brings us together as Americans is so much stronger than anything that can tear us apart. So let me be clear. We are campaigning as a Democrat, but I will govern as an American president.
Today, three of The New Yorker's political writers, Evan Osnos, Jelani Cobb, and Jane Mayer, join me to talk about why the much-discussed blue wave failed to materialize and what the country's sharp divides mean for the future. Thank you all so much for joining me during this horrendous week. So, Evan, I want to start with you. You recently profiled Joe Biden for the magazine. If he does eke out a victory, he faces probably even more overwhelming problems than he expected. He won't have won with any clear mandate. Half the country apparently still believes in the Trump presidency Biden spent the entire campaign condemning. And assuming the Senate stays in Republican hands, Mitch McConnell promises to thwart Biden at every turn. So what conclusions have you come away with about the Democratic Party's handicaps, both in the 2016 and in the 2020 presidential races and going forward?
Well, you know, look, there's obviously a huge amount that we still don't know, but there are a few things that we do know at this point. If you start with the race itself, you see that Biden did make some gains with working class voters in the Midwest. I mean, it was enough to help him win back places like Wisconsin and Michigan, along with, I should say, very importantly, black voters in the cities there. And this would not have happened without that. So that's a big piece of the story. But basically, Trump still held on to a lot of what we have come to call the working class voters in places like Florida and elsewhere. I keep coming back to one important data point, which helps explain why Joe Biden became the nominee at all. And I think perhaps also why Trump was as durable in this race as he was. And that's that if you look at the Democratic Party, most members in the party still describe themselves as moderate or conservative Democrats. And so even though we tend to focus a lot on the sort of frontier of the party and where it seems to be going in the years ahead, that's not where the bulk of the voters still are. I think for when it comes to governing, what does this mean for Joe Biden? It means that he's coming in with a very constrained hand. I mean, we know that the possibility of people like Elizabeth Warren joining a cabinet or Bernie Sanders as labor secretary, that becomes much less likely. He might be relying on people like Chris Coons from the Senate to come in as Secretary of State instead of Susan Rice. So it really, from the very beginning, will define the parameters. And then in turn, also means that he will be getting pressured from the very beginning from the progressive side of the party to do more.
Jane, does that all sound right to you?
It does, but I'm an outlier a little bit on the dooms talk here. I saw a tweet from Stuart Stevens, who's one of the Never Trumpers from the Republican side, who said, you know, to my new Democratic pals, cheer up a little bit. You just won the White House, you know, as it appears. And truly, I think people are, maybe because they had exaggerated expectations, they are not noticing the fact that it's incredibly unusual and difficult to unseat an incumbent president. It doesn't happen very often. It's been 28 years since it happened before. And also, when I look around the world, I see strongmen rising, anti-democratic, autocratic leaders all over the world. And what I see in our country is we democratically appear to have defeated him. There's a lot also of kind of doom talk in the press today about how Trump will remain a permanent power and a disruptive force. And certainly that's what he's going to want to do. But, you know, something else that I feel people are not focusing on is he's also the one thing that he's reviled the most all the way through his presidency. He's going to be a loser. You know, losers aren't usually people who have a ton of power in this country. Maybe he'll hold on to his movement. He's going to try to do it maybe and by dangling the possibility of running in 2024 or maybe by launching some kind of Trump TV platform. But again, he looks to be about to be thrown out of the White House. And that's a very big deal.
Can I make a case for pessimism?
Sure, yes, go right ahead.
I agree with a lot of what Jane just said. I agree with everything she just said. I just have some ands to add on. You know, the last time we saw an incumbent president pushed out of the White House, it was George H.W. Bush, who was by all of the kind of measures of someone who represented a part of American democracy. Whereas we're now looking at someone who even a moderate like Joe Biden had to come around to saying represented a threat to American democracy. We also have a recession and a pandemic and all sorts of racial shrapnel flying through the air that you know the president is only exacerbating. And to eke past him, you know, the thing that worries me is that there will be just close enough. It's like the Hagler-Leonard fight, you know, where it's a Rorschach test. People watch that fight over the course of 30 years or however long it's been. And there's still groups that say Hagler won and people who say Leonard won. It's a never-ending debate about it. And I worry that this will be something that gives just enough credence to Trumpism that it doesn't get, you know, interred in the trash heap of history, but it winds up hanging around like a kind of presidential lost cause phenomenon. And then lastly, I think that Trump is lionized by a group of people who feel like they're all dressed up with no one to shoot. And you know, all of those people who are got out their best camo and, you know, their assault rifles and started marching around are not going to go quietly into the night.
It's also interesting, you know, Biden made such a concerted effort to reach out to Black and other minority voters. And of course, his choice of Kamala Harris for his vice presidential running mate was historic. It seems as though he succeeded on that front. What are we seeing in this election about the power of the Black vote?
It seems like it's another both and kind of situation, which is that we're now looking at Fulton County and in particular John Lewis's old district to see if that bastion of Black Democratic voters will be enough to deliver the state of Georgia to the Biden camp. That's huge. That's gigantic. And on the other side, we've seen what appear to be some increases, even if it just gets back to the baseline of Black voters who went for Bush in 2004 and 2000. And so, you know, we've seen movement in both of those directions. But I think a bigger kind of more historical sense is that a lot of people know that African-Americans, at least African-American men, got the right to vote after the Civil War. But it's less known for what the reasoning of it was. The 15th Amendment was designed to create a group of voters who would be a counterpoint to Southern Democrats to prevent the rise of a kind of segregationist power once again. And so it's not lost on me that 150 years later and 100 years after the passage of the 19th Amendment, we're looking at African-American voters, particularly African-American women voters, and asking them to do the same thing, essentially save democracy.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Jane, I wanted to ask you about the huge sums of money that Democrats raised this election cycle. We know Mike Bloomberg donated $100 million to the Biden campaign for its ground game in Florida. Jamie Harrison lost to Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, despite having raised $200 million for his campaign, the most expensive Senate defeat in U.S. history. And then in Kentucky, Amy McGrath reportedly raised around $30 million more than her opponent, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who defeated her handily. Why didn't the money make a difference?
Well, I don't think you can say that the money didn't necessarily make a difference. I mean, it may have made many people competitive where they wouldn't have had a chance to be competitive before. It's an insane and really revolting amount of money that has been spent on this election cycle. People at various watchdog groups were projecting it'll be about $14 billion, which is on the White House and the congressional races combined. And that's more than twice what it was in 2016. I think what we saw this year was the Democrats rushing in to spend as much as and more than Republicans usually do. They were motivated by, you know, an outpouring against Trump. And, you know, you can't really buy a race necessarily. There are many examples through history of the candidate who spent more being defeated. But you can lose a race if you don't have enough money. So I don't think you can say that the money didn't make a difference. It may have just been oversaturation to the point that it just evened things out. When you look historically at what money has been able to buy, it's most effective when it's tapping into a system like what the Koch brothers, for instance, built, where there was sort of interlocking groups and think tanks and working with the NRA and a get out the vote process door to door. It's not just buying ads. And that's something that the Kochs figured out 40 years ago. And the Democrats are behind on that. So the Democrats may have thrown it at the candidates, but they maybe need to think about the infrastructure.
Yeah, they're decades behind. You wrote a story for the magazine this week that's gotten a lot of attention. You basically outlined everything that Trump faces if he does indeed lose the White House. Could you just briefly review what's ahead of him and maybe anything new you've picked up in the recent days?
Well, I mean, everything is ahead of him, from the possibility of launching Trump TV, where there is actually a backer that came forward in that story. Bernard Marcus, the co-founder of Home Depot, has endorsed the idea of backing maybe some kind of Trump television platform. And the other possibility on the other end of the spectrum is that Trump could be marched off to Rikers Island, literally. The investigation that is going on, the criminal investigation into Trump in New York, is serious. And according to people I interviewed about it, it's got a lot of traction. It's wide ranging. It goes beyond the hush money payments to cover up Stormy Daniels. Among the people cooperating is Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who knows a ton, and who went to jail himself on related charges. So you can't really just say this is picking on Trump, since somebody in a related case has already served time. There's a lot hanging over Trump. And part of the reason people were telling me he was running so hard was he's not just running for re-election, he was running from the law.
Yeah. So he's, unsurprisingly, Jane, following through with all of the threats he's made that he's going to contest election results that favored Biden, and he's demanded a recount in Wisconsin, which even former Republican Governor Scott Walker advises against, saying that the Biden's lead is just too big. But more significantly, it seems he's filing lawsuits in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Georgia. It's been interesting to watch Biden campaign lawyer Bob Bauer, who's been taking a really hard line on all of this, and he says they're totally meritless and doomed to fail. Nice seeing a Democrat being that sort of firm. What are you hearing?
Well, I mean, I think they've learned something from Bush v. Gore. They're going to be much more aggressive. You could see that Biden got out ahead this time. He wasn't waiting for the other candidate to define it. The person I follow a lot on this subject is Richard Hazen, who's a terrific election lawyer, a professor of law. And he basically said that these cases so far do not look like any of them would be particularly promising. What the people who knew Trump well told me for that story was that this could be a very dangerous period, this lame duck period, that he could feel cornered, that he could also try to basically smash and grab, break a lot of things, and also give out a lot of pardons, pre-pardoning his, you know, people in his circle and in his family, and maybe even trying to pardon himself, which would be a real test of the Constitution. It hasn't been tried before by a president.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think one of the things that the Biden campaign was talking about even before Election Day was, you know, they were fully anticipating what Trump was going to do, file the sort of legal shock and awe campaign, and that was the plan. And they were very mindful, very much as Jane mentions, they were thinking about 2000 and saying, what we need to do is project the sense of inevitability, that if it looks like we have really won this thing, we cannot allow ourselves to be dragged into the kind of illusion of a contest. Now, we don't want to do it so fast that they end up looking presumptuous, but don't allow the, you know, to use the dreaded word, the narrative to be defined by somebody who was going to do that. But I think there's another thing worth mentioning, which is picking up on what Jelani said about this kind of folks who are now all dressed up in their camo with nowhere to go. We are in a really volatile moment because of this culture of entrenched political warfare. And I use that word advisedly. I mean, it is really odd that other countries are looking at us and wondering whether we're going to be breaking out in armed conflict. I mean, I saw a friend here in Washington the other day who's a great foreign correspondent who I've worked with overseas in various places. And she's, you know, got this background that takes her back to Libya and Lebanon and all these amazing places. And she was at a couple of rallies in Pennsylvania where you had armed groups on both sides. And she was having to tell the intern that was with them, hey, you know, remember that if shots start firing, you got to go behind something heavier than a car door because it won't be enough to insulate you against gunfire. And she says, I never really thought that I would need to be dispensing that advice in a U.S. presidential election.
So just picking up on that, Jelani, a consensus is emerging that America has basically become two countries, and analogies are being made, including by Evan, by the way, in the piece he's writing this week, about the North and the South in the years leading up to the Civil War. As an American historian, how worried are you about what we're beginning to see?
I'm very worried about it. And I also think, you know, the dynamics that produced Trumpism have not gone away. You know, for all the ideas that people talked about in terms of the, you know, the white working class, they're no better off now than they were then. It's still possible that, you know, the kind of secret sauce that Trump has come up with, you know, you may not have someone who immediately has the same sort of malignant charisma that he has to be able to activate those people, but they're still liable, you know, and all the things about misinformation, still true. The contempt for immigrants and the significant amount of our population that has recently immigrated or has immigrated in recent years, still a high enough proportion to spark those resentments. And the idea that Black people had somehow leapfrogged ahead and that that white people were now a group that, you know, had lost out, there's still people who that argument appeals to. And so I don't think that we get to just kind of move right past. And even some of the kind of partisan conflicts and the way political parties collapse, you know, which is a piece that I've been working on. Some of that applies here as well in terms of, you know, what political parties do when they're facing demographic shifts or kind of demographic dead ends. right now looks to be, you know, much more evenly matched than we expected it to be. But numerically and demographically, there still is a big problem confronting the Republican Party. And it still does have a reason to invest in voter suppression to get around the fact that it may have maxed out its appeal to the part of the population.
But don't you think it's also a problem facing the Democratic Party for the, you know, all of this expectation about the Latino vote and how quickly the country is changing demographically? The Latino vote is far from a monolith. Both parties have really big reckonings ahead of themselves.
Sure. And you know, one of the things that's interesting is that when we talk about, you know, the collapse of political parties in the United States, you know, we our two-party system has collapsed twice before. The thing that damages one party almost always winds up damaging the other party. You know, the collapse of the Federalists after 1812 made it seem like it was just an open field for the Democratic Republicans. And they made it three presidential elections before they blew up themselves and imploded. You know, it's more a question of there being kind of seismic political concerns in the United States and a question of which party will do better in terms of finessing their way through them.
If I was to take off the rose-colored glasses I had on earlier, I do think we have to acknowledge that if 2016 was looked at as a fluke election, what's depressing for many people looking at this one is it was a choice made with open eyes by almost 70 million voters for Trump. Many Americans prefer Trump's brand of politics, and he neither invented it nor will it be expunged when he leaves the stage, if he does, you know, even if he's off on the sidelines completely. So we've got a, you know, so that's I accounts for, I think, as much as the depression about the Democrats not taking the Senate is the sense that this was, there are a lot of people who still backed Trump, even in the midst of this pandemic where he seems to have so bungled it. God knows what it would have been like without the pandemic.
And Evan, both you and Chelani have written a lot about the resistance and continuing confrontations between groups like the Proud Boys and Antifa. And maybe you both could speak a little bit to what we're likely to see in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, I think what worries me is that if you take a combination of what Jane was just referring to, which is the idea that close to 70 million Americans responded to the message that Donald Trump was selling, and then you combine it with the fact that we have these hardened tribal boundaries in this country, what you come to is the realization that it's really almost less of a political problem than it is like a fundamental moral health issue in this country. And that's what worries me, is like you can't begin to address this until you can persuade people in some significant number that things, and this sounds so gauzy and soft that it's almost kind of, you know, unfashionable to talk about it in political discussion, but things like fundamental compassion and fundamental sense of citizenship and fellow feeling, that if as long as those are treated as kind of off the table of politics, then we're really in trouble. Because I think what we've seen is it's not enough to just assume that demographics is destiny and the Democratic Party will eventually begin to absorb all of these new categories of immigrants and others. We have to figure out a way ultimately to change the tenor of politics from the very top to the very bottom. And it's so vast that I think it's somewhat a terrifying prospect, except the good news is there is actually work on this subject that is beginning to happen. I mean, one of the things I write about in the magazine, in this piece, is people are beginning to say, okay, what is the civic infrastructure of this country? Things as simple as public spaces in which people who don't look like each other and don't think like each other can be together. There are more libraries in this country than there are Starbucks, and yet we barely use the libraries in any real way. I'm not saying that the libraries are going to be the solution to this, but as much as we sort of think of our politics as manifest in the physical presence of guns in every, you know, more guns than there are people in this country, I think we need to also begin to think about the sort of literal infrastructure of how we begin to make common spaces and common ideas again.
But on an issue level, I was just going to say, you know, there actually is a lot of consensus on many, many issues that you would never believe it from the kind of politics we've been living through. But, it, you know, there's consensus, for instance, big consensus that something should be done about climate change, and big consensus that there needs to be something done about, you know, some kind of common sense gun control. And there's even consensus on abortion in favor of choice. You would never, ever believe it from the way things have been fought over recently. And I think one of the things that prevents the sort of, you know, middle from having power is that there's such a lot of money in extreme donors and private interests that have captured the Congress and our politics generally. So I would look towards reforms also that try to restrain money if you want to try to reach more common ground.
And some of these reforms are already well underway. And this is one of the things that gives me some hope. I mean, we should know that there was an enormous voter turnout this election. That is not a small thing. And that has not been the case in recent elections. And there have been so many peaceful grassroots efforts to change what is wrong with our system, some of them quite successful. So, Jelani, maybe you could speak to that just a little bit about whether you see hope there, along with some of the scary, violent movements we're seeing.
Yeah, and I also want to just echo Evan's point about libraries. You know, I've often, you know, said that I think that libraries are such a radically democratic idea that we often overlook. The prospect that we have these institutions that are, you know, placed throughout communities where people can literally just walk in and be educated or educate themselves on any subject. And then we have these products, books, which people sell for a profit in lots of places. But in this place, you go and they are free and you have access to them just because you are an interested party in the society. And so I think that those things are important. I think that, you know, having awakened the number of people who were involved in the system and getting out the vote and so on, that is, I don't think that goes away. That giant doesn't go back to sleep necessarily very easily. I think that that's, a really good point. And I also think that in the long view of things, if we, you know, look at the election, really, really fraught elections of, 1824, 1876, and 2000, people find a way to navigate forward, without, a great deal of, at least not the kind of explosive violence that we see in the midst of the election. We also have to talk about election of 1860, but I don't think we're exactly there.
And Evan, do you want to have a final word with a note of optimism?
Well, I'm not sure I would go quite that far as to say I'm optimistic, other than to say, I think, to return to one of Jayden's original points, it is worth reminding ourselves what we have just seen, which is that this president who came to office in such a way that did violence to our values appears to be being ushered off stage, the first one-term president in a generation, and will forever be known as that. And I do not in any way underestimate his capacity to do terrible things in the period before he is driven off stage. But if that's in fact the case, that is a credit to the fact that American politics, for all of its significant faults, is still capable of doing that.
Thank you all so much. And to be continued many times over, I'm sure.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Evan Osnos, a New Yorker staff writer, is the author of Joe Biden, The Life, The Run, and What Matters Now. Jane Mayer is the New Yorker's chief Washington correspondent. Her books include Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.